This is a conversation with moral educators, the beginning of a new project. It's an idea which I had, having been editor of the Journal of Moral Education for 35 years, and it's to recognise the contribution of various academics around the world to the foundation and emergence of what might be considered a field of moral education from a number of different disciplines, from empirical research, teaching and learning. Often these colleagues have also been involved in founding, leading and organising a number of moral education related societies in their own countries, to the Journal of Moral Education, the Association for Moral Education, and the Asia Pacific Network for Moral Education in particular. So this is the background. I'd like to welcome most warmly my friend and colleague, Professor Helen Haste, as my first conversationist in this project. I think, Helen, I should say a little bit about our background, because we have a 50-year-old context for this conversation. We're not coming to it afresh as unknown people. And I think it's probably accurate, if not you'll correct me, to say we've dipped in and out of each other's careers and lives over this time, specifically through the JME, Mosaic, which you founded, and which you'll say more about, I'm sure, and AME. We'll probably make clear more of this interconnection as we talk. To begin, I'd like to say how I first became aware of you, Helen, and your international work, which was around 1976, when I succeeded our mutual friend and colleague, Professor Derek Wright, as editor of the Journal of Moral Education. By then, you'd already published a paper in JME about Kohlberg and Piaget and their work in relation to the field of moral education. And in 1977, I had the pleasure of accepting your paper, Some Consequences of Replicating Kohlberg's Original Moral Development Study on a British Sample, which was based on your higher education studies. And that was published in JME. So I'm wondering, to start this conversation, if you could tell us a bit about your early academic life and how you became interested in moral reasoning, because by then you'd got a first degree in psychology and an MPhil, I believe.
Yes. Well, Monica, how wonderful to talk with you. And I think it's a fantastic opportunity to talk about a very, very rich history that we shared professionally and indeed also personally and socially. I mean, I think of all the years that we've worked with each other and with other people, we have been very productive in a very, very wide variety of ways. And I think the field has been an extremely interesting field because it has it's had its own trajectory, its own developments, but also it's spread out into so many other areas, so many other fields of education and thinking about education. And the other great thing about the field is that, of course, it's very multidisciplinary. I mean, you're a philosopher, I'm a psychologist. We have colleagues and friends who are sociologists. We have people who are working in neuroscience. We have people working in anthropology, and we all share a kind of common enthusiasm for asking these questions, which inevitably cross disciplinary boundaries, which I think is a very important part, not only of our own particular world, but I think also actually of the emergence of thinking about education in the last 50 or a lot more years. So thank you again for organising this project. Now, you asked me a question about how I came to be interested in moral development and moral reasoning. Well, it goes back really to my childhood. I was first of all, I was born in Britain, and my family emigrated, as we're now called rather pejoratively, 10-pound Poms, to Australia when I was nearly seven. So I had 7 lit years living in Australia, which was itself an experience of cultural identity shock and clash. And I then came back to England when I was 13, expecting to be going home, and found myself perceived as a bizarre, weird character who'd spent all half a childhood away. I went to a fairly rural country grammar school, and my friends didn't know what to make of me. Now, I say that's important because I was very much exposed early on to comparative cultures, to comparative moral systems, moral perspectives. I mean, really, the way that people thought about things at the most kind of basic, like normative level in Australian schools was very different from how they did in Britain. And also, I was brought up to be an atheist, which was not exactly what most of my friends were. And many of them spent some time trying to, if not convert me, they failed, but they kept praying for me so that I would be, in case I got run over by a bus tomorrow, I wouldn't actually go to a bad place, but would actually end up in the right place if I was prayed for. I sound slightly flippant, but it was quite serious when I was 13 and 14. But already I had a strong sense of moral ambiguity, if you like. My family were very, we had an excellent library, and my parents were very highly educated, and we talked a lot about ethical and moral issues, not under that heading, as children. And I grew up reading the kind of, the core stuff that one does if one comes from that background, like Margaret Mead and Bertrand Russell and so forth, and Freud and so on. That sounds rather arrogant, but that's really what my family's, I mean, the penguin blue pelicans, we had a great deal to be rewarded for in creating a kind of very popular, accessible cultural world to my generation of young people. So that's the kind of background that I came from. So when it came to
Could I just ask you one question about that, Helen? Because we all know our early years are formative, and in that respect, you had a huge, shall we say, advantage, intellectual advantage over a person like myself. There was a small library, but it wasn't anything like the books that you described. So it was more natural history in my case. But you mentioned interestingly the differences that you were in a position to compare from your earlier, primary school years, mainly in the Australian system, and when you came back to Britain. So you saw those as culturally very different, did you?
Well, I would say I wouldn't say at that stage I saw them as that. I experienced them as that. I mean, it's just being an immigrant, any kind of immigrant, you are inevitably exposed to a world which just doesn't match onto your own identity. And I mean, most trivial things sometimes, but there's a sense that you don't belong. And if you want to belong, you have to make a special effort to belong. And you might not want to move in that direction to belong. And I mean, all
So you
children.
did that twice, really. You did that twice. You did it once going from the UK to Australia. You were having to make an effort to belong. And then when you came back, you were having to make an effort to belong all over again. Is that right?
That's absolutely true, and certainly it was challenging in its own. It was interesting in its own ways. I mean, it really meant that I was grounded thoroughly in a multiple cultural perspective, and I wasn't cosily in one culture. I was always aware, personally, of different cultures. But of course, later on, that translated into academic interests of cultural concern. So, I mean, that fed very much into becoming what eventually I call myself a cultural psychologist. So.
In one or two of your more personal writings, or you've let me see kindly in advance of this conversation, and where you've been interviewed by other people, you refer to a particular experience in coming back from Australia, your ship was diverted to Cape Town,
Yes.
and you referred to a particular aha sort of moment with that. Would you like to say something briefly about that?
Well, certainly, because I think that was a very important moment in my life. It's funnily enough, I've actually found a letter I had written at the time to a friend describing the journey, but I realized in the letter I only described the physical aspects, literally the mountains and the Table Mountain, things like that. I didn't describe what actually I subsequently realized was it's the serious psychological changes. Basically, my family grew up. We were good liberals. I mean, obviously, my family we would now say anti-racist and so on. But in Australia, had a White Australia policy, which, by the way, only ended in 1973. So I grew up in a completely white world, except for the Aboriginals, who were, the anomaly of this world. So I didn't have any experience really of interacting or being aware of a multicultural environment. Now, the boat we came back to England on was supposed to go basically the standard route, Sydney, Melbourne, across the Indian Ocean, up through the Suez Canal and to England. In the middle of this was September 1956. In the middle of the Indian Ocean, the boat stopped because NASA had just closed the Suez Canal. And therefore, we could not go to the Suez Canal because basically it's closed. So, apart from thinking, is World War III breaking out? We had to change direction. So, we then had to go round the Cape and we stopped in Cape Town. This is the height of apartheid. I was extremely unprepared for this. My family may have been good liberals, but they certainly didn't have a sensitivity to these issues. And I was confronted suddenly with the total, absolutely in-your-face world of apartheid, of very, very clear segregation between blacks and whites, which was extremely evident to my extremely untutored 13-year-old mind. It'd be like going to Mississippi at the same time, I guess it would have been if you were a Northern American kid. So I remember that as being deeply shocking, and deeply and powerfully influential in my being aware of injustice and, well, it's more than injustice, it was inhumanity. And I did actually write a few years later, wrote an essay for competition on it. And subsequently, I've found that experience to be very central in forming my sense of anger and distress at a particular kind of public immorality, if you like. So.
Yes, I've got in my hand here, I happen to find it, a copy of an article you wrote that was published in autumn 1997 in your University of Bath magazine. And one of the paragraphs, the third one actually, says, "I would not disclaim personal passion. Looking back, I see how specific experiences fired me with moral outrage, which later turned into more reflective and academic questions." And you then go on to talk about this particular episode in Cape Town. So you've just linked that up again with your old feeling, as it were, anger, moral anger about injustice.
Yes.
Inhumanity. Now, the interesting thing is, and I don't want to dwell on this for too long because, unlike me, it seems to me your work hasn't focused particularly on race or racial injustice and ethnic identity. It's taken a different form. But I thought it was interesting that you'd lived in Australia, but not seriously been aware of the discrimination and injustice to the native peoples, but you had been aware of it when it was in your face briefly in Cape Town.
There was no culture in Australia at that time. of what we now possibly label critical race theory, we were aware of the position of the Aboriginal people. We occasionally saw them in, but not very often in Sydney, but we were sort of aware of them. But it was more, it wasn't something that was in your face about morality. It was, there was a sense that more should be being done about the inequalities and dealing with what was actually a huge, seen as a huge cultural gap between the lifestyles and opportunities available for the Aboriginal people compared to the white population, which incidentally was almost, it wasn't 100% immigrant, of course, because after all, Australia had been around for a while, but there's a very strong sense in which a lot of people one met had come over quite recently, either themselves or their families. They had come from somewhere else. There was an old country out there. The old country was usually Britain, but sometimes it was other countries. So we were very much an immigrant society, and we it wasn't it was never addressed, as I remember, at all when I was in Australia. Only later on, when people became aware of it and became passionate about it.
Of course, this is what happened with the Windrush generation and people from the Asian subcontinent coming to Britain post-war. They felt they were coming to the old country and so on. So the kind of interesting relationships between these two things. Now, I don't want to dwell on this because I want to get you to the point where you became sufficiently academically qualified, as we all have to be, right? And you started your research on moral reasoning. Now, you've had two main institutions, academic institutions in your life, University of Bath, where you've been, you were on the staff, going from assistant professor or whatever you're called at the beginning, because titles changed over the years, lecturer in psychology, and in 1971, and then you gradually rose to be head of professor of psychology in 98 and head of the department till 2001. And the other main institution, academic institution ongoing in your life has been Harvard University in America. So these are two very important strands. And I remember when I first became aware of you, I was very conscious that you were the first British person, I won't say person, not just woman, to cross the pond in our field. And you've largely remained that person. I mean, I myself only had a very short sabbatical at Harvard in 87, and mostly in the Bronx because I was looking at the Kohlberg project, and back and forth to AME. So you have sustained a visiting career at Harvard, and after you retired from Bath, you then went to Harvard for 15 years, from 2013 to 18. So I'm very interested in how both these two institutions affected your work, because from my perception of them, they're somewhat different institutions, and they would themselves have different ways of operating and probably slightly different values, and how your involvement with Harvard came about, because I think I'm right in saying that was through your interest in moral values and moral reasoning. So can we make the leap from your early academic life when you became qualified, as it were, to how did you then get to go across the pond and why?
Okay, well, I'll try and keep it fairly brief. Picking up the earlier point about how I got involved specifically in moral development as a topic, I mean, obviously, the background I described was was quite likely to alert me to moral issues. It did. And so when it came to looking for a graduate research program, I got into University of Sussex to do graduate work. I thought I really am interested in moral development of moral values, because that was very much part of my background. And so I was looking around of ways of studying that. And at that point, this was 1967. Larry Kohlberg had basically published a few papers, but had certainly made a name for himself, and was certainly, or by then, that was actually the year he went to Harvard, as a matter of fact. But he had made a reputation with actually at that point a relatively few articles, but very, very rich and complex, and of course his PhD thesis, which he did at Chicago. Now, he interviewed, as we all know, boys aged 10, 13, and 16. And of course, he then followed it up for 20 years. But at the time that I was discovering my own interests, it was his early work was being published. And I thought, this is it suddenly grabbed me. This is really interesting, looking at development of moral reasoning, which is what Larry was doing. And it fitted so much with my interests in morality, which were there. And so I basically thought, right, well, what I'll do with my project, I'll try to replicate what Larry did originally in Chicago. So I interviewed 90 boys aged 10, 13, and actually 15, because I wanted to get them where they were still full time in school, and interviewed them using actually all the original nine dilemmas that Larry had used. I interviewed them and they analysed them basically using Kohlberg's thesis, because there wasn't much published. Nothing was published at that point on actually how to score the data. And that was what I was doing in between about 67 and about 71, 72. And as you say, I published a couple of papers. However, I didn't get involved in going to Harvard immediately. And to some extent, I moved away a bit from moral development when I completed my MPhil thesis. It was only when Derek Wright organized the conference in 1977,
Yes.
which he drew to help him, a whole cluster of us who were all, including you, of course, young people who were very young. We were all like 30 or 30, younger, most of us were under 35. He got together about a number of people who were the core of people who were working in moral education and moral development in Britain. There weren't many of us, and people in a sort of similar area. About 100 people at that conference, I think.
A seminal conference.
Absolutely seminal. And he brought over his team from Harvard,
Yeah.
and Higgins, Anne Colby, Bill Pooker. And basically we engaged in 3 or 4 days of extremely intensive discussions, interesting debates and interesting disagreements, which looking back was an extraordinary time. So I reawakened my interest in moral development. I'd rather moved into feminist psychology by then. And I was really awakened my interest, and I thought, this is I this play, this field is going somewhere intellectually. It's exciting, and so I got the opportunity to go. I think a year after, or maybe 2 years later, to spend a few weeks, 3 or 4 weeks, I think it was, in the Harvard Center for Moral Education in Larson Hall, Nepean Way, in Harvard Graduate School of Education. And realized that this was a place I really liked being. And I was there for that summer. And then I went back again for a period of about a whole semester in 1980, and also the summer of 1981, where I spent the whole time really looking at the original Kohlbergian longitudinal data, which by then, of course, had been completed as a the longitudinal study had been completed, and got really immersed in thinking about that. So that got me back into the field. It also got me into that world. Now, as everyone knows, Larry Kohlberg is an unusual person in that he really created an extremely supportive and rich and dynamic cultural environment for his research teams. people were very welcome from all over the world, and they were fully engaged, they were fully involved, and anything that they were doing was valued, however peripheral it might seem to the main team. So it was an extremely welcoming environment and a very stimulating one, and again a very cross-disciplinary one. So I spent that time in 1980-81, and then really quite regularly returned for short periods to the centre, as many people like me did from internationally in other countries, and spent time, short time, long time, and became part of that centre as long as it survived until Larry's death in 1987.
Yes, certain people did their PhDs there, like Dwight Boyd and Fritz Oster,
Yes,
so
indeed.
on. Yes, so it was a very vibrant centre for moral education right up until Larry's death early in 1987, and it so happened that. He'd asked me, invited me to go. I'd been working with him for the first couple of years when I was editor of the journal, and then he asked Anne Colby to take over from him because you may remember Helen, he co-edited to some extent with Derek Wright, the JME, until the mid 70s because Derek was very instrumental in setting up that transatlantic connection, and he and Larry had a particularly good personal relationship. You know, they got on well together personally and academically, and that's how that came about. But so I was actually there when Larry's memorial service was held in Harvard in 1987. So that was a very sad time, and people were unsure about the future of the centre. But you managed to continue your connections with the people who had been there in an academic way of doing research, and you worked with several of them still, didn't you?
Yes, well, after Larry died and the centre, in a sense, it didn't dissolve exactly. It sort of spread. I mean, the people who had been involved remained involved, even if they weren't physically in Harvard. That community remained a very strong community, and in a sense, it still does in many ways. And the people who were there continued to do work. Of course, I mean, certainly. Anne Higgins and Clark Bower were doing a lot of work on the Just Community, which I know you were involved in as well.
I
So
went to some of it, yes.
they continued to be working in that area. I went back as well as the time I spent while the centres existed. I went back again. Now, one thing, Anne Colby took over the directorship of the Henry Murray Centre, which is part of College. And the other thing about that is that that was the location of the data. All the Colebergian data moved out of it out of the centre when it no longer ceased to exist, and was in fact housed in the Murray Centre. So I spent some time also looking again at the data in the Murray Centre as a visiting fellow at the Murray Centre, and I remained in close contact personally. With people as a friend and to some extent a colleague, and even as my interests moved away, it was still quite closely attached to that particular community, which, because of the point about the community, it was not a community which was following the what you might call the disciple route. I wrote a thing which I am rather pleased with, which I just differentiated true believers from critical insiders and critical outsiders. The true believer sort of worships at the shrine and doesn't push it forward. The critical insiders and critical outsiders, people who have taken the kind of the source material, the source ideas, the source energy, and take it in many different directions. And there are a lot of people who Larry's lab were generated, people like that, who went out and did things and spread and differentiated, elaborated. And those are the people who I remained in close contact with. So I was That connection remained right through really the 90s. And then in 1998, Bob Selman, who was again very much part of that world, somebody went on leave, who was teaching not moral education at HGSE but gender, and he needed a temporary replacement to come and teach some gender courses, which by then I was very much involved with, working in gender. And so I said, he said, come over in for a semester and basically teach whatever you like. So I did. I was thrilled. So I spent that semester of the spring of 98 back in the Ed School, not teaching moral education, but teaching issues around gender, and again re-establishing my connections. And then in 90, sorry, 2003, what happened was that Carol Gilligan moved to New York University, and they sort of needed someone to kind of teach her courses. And by that time, I was then 60, so I was sort of thinking, what do I do next? I was still at Bath. And Bob said, come over for and basically, if you like, fill the gap more or less. So I said, fine. So I said half a year. The contract was half a year there, and I read half a year in Bath, and actually that was a short-term part-time contract that became 15 years, still part-time but not short-term, as I kind of became part of the Harvard graduate school education world. Again, not doing a lot in the field specifically of moral education, because by then I'd moved over much more into civic education and also issues around gender. But that's my long-term connection. But your question about how I fitted in, I suppose, is your question. I think I very much found the HDSC world is very much a world which values the things I value. It values, well, cross-disciplinary work very much, and I feel very strongly about that as an educator, personally, and as an intellectual myself. I don't find the boundaries very helpful. Secondly, it was a place which really made education an academically, intellectually important topic, not, as unfortunately happens in many institutions, primarily, although it's important, a training ground for teachers. That's an important part of education, but to really be pushing the field forward and having the richness to develop innovative ideas, you need a climate which is valuing and nurturing research and thinking and innovation and that kind of excitement. And the Ed School did that, and I felt being a bit of a kind of gadfly, I suppose, I belonged there, I found that incredibly stimulating.
I wouldn't have described you as a gadfly, Helen. I've always thought of you as having much more of a sustained impact rather than just flitting. But I think a climate of institutions is very important for us in terms of our professional endeavours. And I suppose my question about how did both your two institutions affect your thinking, work, and ability to work? Is because your academic institution in the UK was much more flexible than my own, whereby you were able to negotiate some of these periods that you've described out of it. Elsewhere at Harvard. But when you were at Bath, you were focusing more directly on psychology as such, were you?
That doesn't quite describe it. I went to Bath in 71, and I was a lecturer in the School of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences. Now, the School of Humanities and Social Sciences was a pretty broad place. There were two primary degrees, sociology and economics, and there were a number of other subjects taught which were basically feeding into those main degrees. And psychology was a contributor to the primarily what was actually, I suppose, the social work degree, and the sociology emphasis around that. And there were actually only two of us psychologists initially. And I first went there actually thinking, well, it's a By the way, at that point, Bath was 5 years old, so it was a very, very new university that nobody had heard of. I rather saw it as a place which I would spend a few years at, get some publications, and then move into a, quote, real department of psychology somewhere in Britain. So that was my original expectation in 1971. And I was teaching psychology to initially social work students, but it was a time when psychology was beginning to emerge as a quite interesting subject. It had been rather, when I was an undergraduate doing it, it was a bit tied to old-fashioned behaviourism. It was becoming more interesting by the time I was at Bath, and there were opportunities to push the boundaries a bit. And certainly the students were very interested in psychology, and so increasingly we were able to provide more psychology courses throughout the 70s. And by the early 80s, we actually managed to get recognition from the British Psychological Society that we were a legitimate department of psychology, giving psychology degrees, which meant that actually we really were, onto a good thing by then. And so we built up the gradually built up the Department of Psychology as a small group within the larger School of Social Sciences, and expanded in some interesting ways. Now, one of the points about being in Bath at that time, which is a new university, ex-cat, not an ex-poly, an ex-cat.
Can you say what a cat was?
Was going to say, College of Advanced Technology.
Yes.
The College of Advanced Technologies, some of the new universities were these places. Now, they were places that had been established usually in the 19th century to train engineers and technicians of various sorts. And the primary courses, and as they became universities, the primary research was in engineering or in the sciences broadly. And the humanities existed as a sort of leavening, if you like, broadening the education of these young, they were originally, of course, young men who were going to go into engineering and science, technology, and related fields. So the humanities were really on the edge of this. Now, what happened at Bath was the humanities have attracted some. It was the 1970s, and there were a lot of very bright young people around as the universities are expanding, and they appointed some very bright young people into the School of Social Sciences, as it then was, and out of that arose some very interesting developments in the various fields that were recruiting, and it became a really quite an interesting university. Now, we split into actual departments as opposed to being the school in 1997, and psychology became an independent department, by which time we had a very successful degree program. But we were also, because we were not in a conventional mainstream department of psychology, nobody was leaning on us to say this is or this is not psychology, provided our degree was recognised by the BPS, which it was. And the people who we appointed in psychology were deliberately chosen to be interesting and unusual and innovative and experimenting with ideas. So we had some fascinating master's programs in science, culture, and communication, which is really cross-disciplinary, in applied social psychology, which has also included economic psychology, in health psychology, in human communication and computing. So we had all these exciting master's programs, which are pushing the boundaries of what psychology was. And we were not worried about at that point becoming a rather conventional, cognitive neuroscience department, which other places were. We were really being exciting and doing things like critical psychology and cultural psychology and psychology interfacing with philosophy. So it was a pretty exciting place. But let me go back a bit to when I, in the 1970s, and why I stayed at Bath. Because I didn't have a lot of choice because one of the problems with doing moral development research in the 19 in the 19 six in the early years of it, that it was not popular. In fact, I was firmly told when I was doing moral development research in the late 60s and the early 70s, this was not a good career move. It was not a popular field. It was regarded as very peripheral to psychology. It was not regarded as scientifically at all sound. At best, it might have been seen vaguely philosophical. It was not a good place to be, firstly. So, in other words, academically, it didn't fit in Britain. Secondly, I was doing work on moral development, a post-Kantian deontological theoretical model, very much focusing on justice and absolutely focusing on reason. Now, in Britain, we don't think of morality in terms of reasoning. We think of morality at the popular level in terms of virtue. And virtues are the dominant way of thinking about morality. And reason is, at best, a game. Certainly, it's suspicious because what's reason got to do with your actions? What's reason got to do with your feelings? What's reason got to do with your virtues? Now, I remember a number of fairly bruising talks I gave in the early 70s to schools, teachers, to educators, talking about my rather enthusiastic approach to Kohlbergian moral stages and being pretty much battered by it. It was not a popular topic at all. It did not go down well. And for some people, also, it was elitist. That was the thing, it was elitist because stages of moral development, for heaven's sake, how elitist can you get? And as well as being elitist, therefore, it was also not consistent with left-wing ideology. So, in fact, there were lots. So there's no point me trying to apply for jobs elsewhere in Britain because nobody wanted anyone working in moral development, firstly. Secondly, I was also by then involved in another dangerously pernicious area of work, which is also not scientifically respectable, namely gender.
Yes, I
So,
wanted to come on to that.
right. So basically, I was stuck in Bath because my choices of research were not exactly marketable, but that was just fine because I could be involved with a wonderful team of people at Bath in building up a really, really exciting department.
Yes, well, that's very interesting because you obviously had a lot of flexibility, even though the moral aspects of your work were, shall we say, not appreciated. Let's put it as neutrally as possible. If we backtrack slightly, you've also written about, and this relates to gender, you've also written a bit about your involvement in activism, because I did wonder if your interest in moral values, moral development, reasoning, and so on was theoretical, or whether it also had some practical links. And it seemed to me from what I read and what you shared with me, which I think is not perhaps so widely known about you, that you were actually involved in some activism. By that I mean action, to do with some at least CND and some other political activities, and of course in the early 70s, feminism was a big
Yes.
matter of theoretical and practical interest.
Absolutely, Monica. I mean, very much that was part of it. As I said, we talked a little bit about my South Africa experiences, which what it did was to give me an awareness, again, perhaps a little bit more a couple of years later, but the sort of anger and distress and a sense that, this led me to feel a sense of responsibility to do something. So this sense of personal engagement with moral outrage led me to a feeling of I can't just sit here moaning. I've got to do something. So I now my first active engagement was CND, which of course was the main source of activism for young
It was the
lesbians.
campaign for nuclear
Yes,
disarmament.
Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, yes, which I first went to a CND, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament demonstrate march. I went to the Aldermaston March in 1961, I think was the first one I went on. And when I went to university, first of all, I joined CND and was pretty actively involved in peace activism for many years in various forms. I mean, initially it was around anti-nuclear stuff, and then subsequently it moved over into other areas of social activism, eventually gender, but also anti-apartheid issues. And another area I was very involved with was some actively involved in the anti-apartheid movement. And so my South Africa experience precipitated this. So that was going on right through the 60s, certainly. And again, that sense of the close links between an ethical belief system and the feeling that one had a moral responsibility to do something, not just think it. That was there. And when it came to gender, interesting enough, the gender thing was slightly different because I had grown up, because my family were pretty good on liberal issues. My parents were definitely not sexist, and anyway, and the expectation was that all of us, whatever gender we the four of us, in my family, we would all succeed in whatever we did. There's never any question that because we were girls, anything would get in the way at all. So I grew up believing I could do anything, irrespective of my gender, and so I kind of believe that in a way, when the women's movement began. I rather felt, well, okay, I'm all right. I mean, I haven't experienced, I thought, I hadn't experienced much in the way of gender discrimination, I thought, at that time. I was pleased to see it happening around 1970. And then a couple of things happened, which I won't go into, which made me realize that I was suffering from acute false consciousness and that basically I was deluding myself. And when I re realized that, I realized that I was actually as much a part of the oppressed gender as anybody else. And so I thought, not only should I be aware of it from a distance, being helpful, but actually I should be engaged and involved. So I was and became very engaged and involved. And as I tend to describe it, for a while I was primarily an activist. And then around about 1975, I sort of thought, well, actually, I'm a trained psychologist. I'm a trained researcher. I can do an awful lot more for this movement by actually doing some decent research and publishing it than just walking up and down carrying a banner and signing petitions. Well, I went on carrying a banner and signing petitions, but I also began to do feminist research, particularly in the early days on the relationship between perceptions of science and gender, which meant both the way that science and scientists are very much, were there very much then, seen as a male world and male gendered. And of course, women were discriminated against, against in the context of science. But also, I became very interested in the way that culturally, we think of science as having many of the very prototypical, stereotypical, masculine characteristics of thinking and interacting and behaving and so on. So I was then challenging a whole philosophical perspective as well as why aren't there more girls doing science? Why aren't there more women in science? Why aren't there more women in senior positions? So yes, so my activism was initially in the peace movement and continued to an extent, but shifted very much in the 70s into feminism. And again, the intersection in both those areas of my activism and passions with my intellectual and professional commitments in terms of my choice of research and my theoretical perspectives.
You've identified in at least two papers that I've read, which you've shared with me, four different themes, if you like, in your work, and I identified nearly all of those in what you've just said. So first of all, there were sort of values, morality, and it then sort of shaded into gender and political activism and so on, which then became a bit more to do with civic education and citizenship. But also, you've mentioned the scientific and the culture of science, if you like, was part of it. Then you've, in another way, cut the cake differently, in your very interesting paper called Dancing on the Margins. And you talked about the four themes, if you like, I'm calling them themes, you didn't, which were development of moral reasoning, activism, and gender. And then the second one was to do with language, metaphor, and narrative, and that and how those influence social change and cultural processes, and then youth civic participation, and then social change and its implications for uncertainty, unpredictability, and for education. Now, these are very big themes, and if you like, the soft underbelly. I'm not very keen on that phrase, but it kind of fits with this of a lot of what we would more in a more straight on way think of the meat of moral education and development. These are more what's going on underneath, right? These dimensions and themes.
Yes, that's a very weird, that's an interesting way of putting it. I would say that myself, actually. Yes, I mean, I think that I have to say that I've at various stages in my career, I've moved more and towards and then away from what you might call a central theme of let's call it moral education as such. And I feel that although there is a current an undercurrent going right through my work of relevance of what I do to moral education, very broadly defined, by the way. It hasn't always been explicitly and obviously the most on the surface. But I mean, if you take, for example, you mentioned civic education. Well, it was a completely natural transition for me to move from working in concerns about what we might call moral education into thinking about the obligations and qualities and skills of citizenship. Of course, also the link between moral commitment and moral agency and civic engagement is obviously is very obvious. And so I became very interested in looking slightly more broadly than specifically within a conventional moral context into saying, look, this is a question of civic education. How do you create citizens who can be critical, competent, have agency? And be effective. And that was where I moved into. But to me, that's a completely natural progression. And in some ways, you could say, was either a subset of or a natural extension of my concerns about moral education. So that's a clear line of evolution. As far as, and similarly as well, interest in social change, once you start thinking about civic education, obviously, you're thinking about improving, ideally, society. And obviously, that means you're interested in social change. And of course, if you've been an activist, you've been interested in how social change happens and indeed how maybe you can actually influence it. So, social change as an intellectual, a theoretical question, as well as a practical research question, obviously fits in again with thinking about issues around the issues that start in the field of moral education and moral development and spring naturally, both theoretically and empirically, from that. I'd like to say a bit about the other strand you mentioned, as you say, linking to science and culture, language and metaphor. I'd like to say a little bit about my theoretical interests, if that's appropriate, because
Sure.
it's a fairly important shift. I have to say, I moved away from a commitment to moral stage a theoretical model based upon moral stages. Not because I wanted to retreat into virtues, I didn't, but I felt that it was too much, it seemed to be too much inside the head. I felt that what was missing, perhaps, was a realization that we are embedded in culture, where we are products of the combination of our individual inside the head functioning, our ongoing continuous dialogical relationship with others, whether it's actually literally face to face or other forms, or even just remembering face to face. We generate meaning at the dialogic level. And of course, this takes place within the larger context of the culture. And the culture provides us with the frameworks and framings that enable us to take the petitions and the ways of thinking inside our heads. And of course, also, it makes comprehensible and effective the interactions at the dialogic level. So basically, I became very interested. That comes out of Vygotsky, straight out of Vygotsky. Though, of course, I would acknowledge also the implication of people like Dewey as well. And indeed, pragmatism, but that's another field. But so that idea of looking at what it was that in the culture that was part of the processes by which we make sense, and also part of the processes by which social change takes place, I began to think of actually, it's really about metaphor and language. The metaphors we use to explain everything come from our culture. And those metaphors frame and limit, as well as making possible, ways of thinking. So I got very interested in looking at metaphors and language, because it fitted very much into the broader picture, as I'm saying, of the relationship between the individual, the dialogue, and the cultural framework. And actually, when I got really into sort of trying to consolidate my work on gender as a theoretical system, I wrote the book The Sexual Metaphor, which came
Yes,
in 93.
that's the book I was thinking of. Yes.
It's called The Sexual Metaphor because I realized, having had by then 20 years of working in this field, that actually one of the crucial things that underpins all the issues around inequalities and discrimination and so on around gender, and actually, of course, in parallel also ethnicity, I wasn't studying that, is the metaphors which are embedded in gender, particularly the binary metaphor. Particularly the binary metaphor, it must be either or. As Aristotle said, if it's not A, it must be B, and this you can't, you know, it has to be A or B. Very much a binary metaphor which runs right through our culture, and of course embeds itself in the way we think about gender, and the way we get freaked out about gender. I mean, obviously, at the moment, the hysteria we're seeing around transgender issue is a hysteria around someone challenging a well-established binary that people think with and live with, and we're seeing it coming out very clearly. It's almost interesting, actually, as well as being very worrying. But I mean, the paranoia and the terror that we're seeing in public rhetoric around transgender is part of the kind of binary metaphor that I dealt with a bit in historical terms in The Sexual Metaphor.
Yes, but that wouldn't have been your main theme in the sexual metaphor in
No, it wasn't.
1994 at all. No, and I was going to ask you about that because that's one of your key books and one for which you had a lot of publicity, as I recall.
I had some publicity for it, yes. It didn't have, it wasn't exactly a bestseller, but it got a certain amount of publicity, yes. It
Yes.
got reviewed. It got reviewed quite nicely, but it didn't quite take off, but that's all right. I'm glad I wrote it.
Because, as we know, titles can be influential.
Yes.
Titles of books and articles. I'll come back to that later, if I may. But in preparation for our conversation, I asked you, as a person, the author of seven or so books and over 200 academic papers and many publications in the popular press and as a broadcaster to send me up to six of your works. almost impossible task, one I do think you found difficult, which were covered these categories: most personally satisfying, or academically well received, or influential on research and practice. Because, as we know, these are not necessarily the same things. The things that we derive satisfaction from writing, or difficulty in writing, may or may not have been well received, may or may not have had any influence. Would you like to say anything at all about the papers you sent me, which I hope will list on the website alongside information about this conversation, or is that too difficult?
No, it's not too difficult. It's a bit premature because I think when you asked me to send the six papers, I honestly, first of all, I didn't, it was quite difficult to decide which six would capture what I felt were core themes. But also, I wasn't quite sure how you wanted to approach the interview. So I thought what I'd do is I would postpone the final decision until we've had this conversation, because I think now I can see ways in choosing papers which relate to what we've talked about in the conversation, that was quite helpful. So if you let me come, if you permit me to rethink my six papers in
Yes.
light of this conversation and
Yes.
send them to you. Now, it's a quite silly
Absolutely
question.
useful, actually. And you can say, perhaps you can, if you think my suggested headings are, have any salience, what you found personally satisfying. Because, of course, that varies over a long career.
Yes.
You and I are both, dare I say it, elderly ladies now. We're reflecting about over 50 or 50 plus years of work, right? And what we might say was personally satisfying now might not have been what we would have said when we were in our 40s.
That's a good point, actually. Are we elderly ladies? How about grand old ladies?
Well, officially we're elderly, according
Officially,
to
I
what
know.
happened in COVID. We were suddenly told we were elderly when
We
we
were labelled, yes.
that we were, normally functioning mature women.
As you say, a metaphor that had enormous power, actually, of course.
Yeah, very powerful. So there's that point, and also, what is well received academically, that varies a lot according to fashion. History changes over time. And what is enduringly influential? I mean, I think of something that I did that was very influential at the time and now will have completely dropped off the radar.
Yeah. Well, you can't predict what's going to be influential. I mean, it's an interesting question. I actually quite often like asking people, which of your papers do you think will still be relevant in 50 years' time? And people look at me with rather sort of horror, actually. They even ask the question. But I would actually wonder, some of my most influential in the sense of maybe were widely read papers, actually not the academic ones, but things I wrote when I was trying to do what I believe very strongly in, which is communicate to the wider audience.
Yeah.
I feel quite strongly. You mentioned the 200 published papers. That's what one says in a CV. Actually, I published a lot more than that, but it wasn't in refereed journals. Wouldn't make the ratings for the ref
Yeah.
these days.
But why did you think it was so important also to have, if I may call it, a more popular voice?
Well, I feel very strongly. I mean, you mentioned you described me as an activist, and I think that's a fair comment. I do feel that, on the one hand, I think that if our work, the product of our presumably considerable talents as academicians, just sits in the ivory tower. It's not very useful, and it's not particularly ethical, given how many resources went into creating those ivory towers and the work that was in it. So, I do think that we have an obligation, as let's call it, if you like, intellectuals or academicians, to actually make sure that our work gets out there. It's one thing. Simply at that level, I also think that actually we do have things to say, and we. We are influential. I mean, I'm using we generally. I'm not talking about any individual person, but just generically, new ideas come from, at least in part, from the world of research. They come also very strongly, of course, from the world of humanities, particularly theatre and art. But we have a role as researchers in changing how people think. And I think that I've always felt that that was important to not just sort of do research and feel, say, okay, I've done some research which is sort of vaguely attached to some issue, but actually say, actually, this research should have an impact. It should affect education. What I'm discovering should be actually be out there, that teachers should be seeing it, or people involved in policy should be seeing it. I'm not just talking about my work, I'm talking just generally. And I
You've
would
been
say,
very proactive in all that.
well, I have, yes.
Yes, especially in broadcasting. I'm more aware of that and your appearances from time to time on the radio, for example.
Well,
But you've also written in a number of magazines and popular journals and the press, haven't you?
yes, I have, and that's part of the process of feeling of giving out to the public. I've written. I haven't done much recently since I went to Harvard. But before I went in before I went to Harvard, I was doing a fair amount of things like writing for New Scientist and so on. But a big factor was my involvement with the British Association for the Advancement of Science, to which I would owe a great deal of my personal development as a scholar, and also in the connections I made with people who were really outside psychology and in very interesting different fields. The British Association for the Advancement of Science was founded back in, I think, the 1828, I think it was, thereabouts, as a forum for the arts and sciences to come together at a time when university didn't have very much in the way of, for example, science department, didn't have any actually. And it was a place where people would talk about new ideas. It was very much a place where the public discussion of scientific and innovation was happening. And it's existed since then. And of course, some very important events scientifically took place there. Obviously, it's the first place where Richard Owen talked about defined dinosaurs. It's where Huxley and Wilberforce had their debate in the 1880s, and many other things subsequently. But the British Association still exists. It's slightly different now, but it existed when I. It moves around each year. It did move around each year to different universities, and it came to Bath in 1978, and they needed a secretary for the psychology section. The British Association has many sections for each of the sciences, and I was roped in to be the local secretary for the event when it came to Bath, and which really meant that I very promptly became on the committee and remained on the committee and remained attached to the British Association for 30 years. I actually ended up being chair of council at one point, and I passionately believed, and as many of the anybody who was seriously involved in the British Association passionately believed, that we have an obligation to bring science to the wider world. And of course, the other thing about the British Association is have an excellent relationship with the journalists, the science journalists. So during the annual conference, every day, the major newspapers, Telegraph, Times, Guardian, would have a whole page on British Association talks. And the tabloids would have salacious articles on the more salacious art stories from the British Association. I could tell you of two which I got involved in, but I'll tell you about later if you want to. But the point is that that made me really aware of the importance of communicating science, including social science, and the people involved in the British in the Royal Society. We're also very heavily involved in the British Association. So the people I was sort of talking to and being on committees were the people who are major figures in science, who passionately believed that science should be communicated. That was the period of the Public Understanding of Science initiatives in the late 80s, like Walter Bodmer and so on. And it was a wonderful organisation because it really was a place where there was an intersection between the public and the elite scientific world. And it was really quite exciting to feel something I believed in anyway. I believed in communicating, and suddenly all these people, really eminent people, were believing it and doing it, and I felt completely at home. And I made some very, very good friendships and other relationships through that, which were very important to me professionally and personally in terms of my own development as a thinker. And indeed, it did mean I got into the press quite often, and I learned how to be a communicator. I learned how to be a sort of a good writer, and to be able to talk outside the narrow confines of the academy.
Now, this raises a point which I wonder if you would agree with me, Helen, that in contrast to what you've just told us about your involvement with the British Advancement, British Association for the Advancement of Science, we have never bridged that gap in the moral domain, if I may put it like that. We've never found a way of having a voice as academics interested in moral development and education, moral philosophy and sociology of morality and so on, to bridge the gap between the theory and popular communication.
That's a very good point. I have to say, I did occasionally try to get some of these issues onto the programme as a psychology section. I think we did it once or twice. I think my own experience, as I mentioned earlier on, going back to the early 70s, I think to some extent is part of the problem. British people do not like, or did not, do not like talking about morality in the terminology that the research was working in at that time. And I think that's a problem, that it wasn't a very saleable product. In if you're thinking talking about moral reasoning particularly, and the Kantian deontologic perspective particularly, it wasn't in tune with the British culture. Virtue was, and actually to very many areas of morality certainly were. I mean, all the issues around, society problems, managing how we manage crime and punishment, all those things are very central to our public consciousness and indeed public policy. But I don't think that we were doing, as a community, we're doing that kind of research with that kind of message in mind. And I think that's something, in retrospect, I sometimes think, should we have gone that route more as a community of moral educators and said, look, we have our own very strong perceptions of what we think is important and pushing the boundaries of theory and practice. But are we really tuning in to what people want to hear and want to see done? And I don't say, I have to say, I don't think we did what we could have done. Sometimes I reflect about if we decided, say, in AME, in the British version, I can't go to America, let's just talk about Britain for the moment. If we said, if we'd gone back in, say, 1970s and said, okay, or 1980s and said, how do we want to make ourselves a force for addressing the contemporary moral issues as seen by the British public, and recruiting the kind of writers and journalists and popularizers we could have done at that time, would we have done better in terms of changing education? You see, I think actually we're overtaken eventually by a movement which did take it on board, which is citizenship. I mean, Bernard Crick. I mean, citizenship education picked up in a way what we ought to have picked up perhaps 10, 15 years earlier. And the citizenship education agenda was well publicised and very much was in the public eye, whatever's happened to it subsequently. And in the 90s, certainly, a lot of very interesting stuff was going on at the interface of public awareness and public practice and what was happening in education around citizenship. And I think that maybe we lost enough, some of us actually, we could have done more we lost an opportunity to capitalize on that.
Yes.
And I think, I regret perhaps not pushing that more at the time, but it wasn't really what I was want at that time wanting to do.
Could I just can I just bring us back to our connection with the journal, Moral Education, and say one or two things in reflective answer to you to your points. We should perhaps recall that the origins of the Journal of Moral Education were humanist. They were not directly connected with any religious perspective, though moral education was all subsumed as part of religious education in school prior to citizenship. I'm talking about 60s, 70s, 80s, really. And its origins were in the Social Morality Council. Now, if I was talking to people casually or just dinner party or somewhere, people will say, "Well, what do you do?" Right? So first of all, you start off with your actual occupation, and I'd explain that in educational research. And then I said, "But I also edit Journal of Moral Education." Now, if they were less robust, they take two steps backwards and end of conversation. And what's going on in their minds? So what is and then more and more it became, you were asked, what is moral education? Now, in this sort of social environment, the last thing I wanted to do was explain the niceties, even if I could have, of moral education in wherever we were, 1980s or 90s. Okay. And it was the word moral that was a trigger. As you've identified, when that became transmuted into encompassed in citizenship education in the early 90s, then it became legitimate to talk about it. But as moral, there seemed to be some concern, if I can put it that neutrally, if not indeed fear, of what you were actually going to talk about with somebody if you identified yourself with the tag moral. I quite often found myself saying it's not as right wing as it might appear. And also, it was, I think, because in our society in Britain at the time, and we have to think, back to that because it was different. In some ways, it was a more open, in some ways, a more restricted society. One's morality was considered to be a matter of personal choice, personal values, without being seen explicitly, excuse me, except perhaps by those of us in the academic field, as to some extent socially constructed. And other people would have come at it from the religious domain. So there were some impediments to having a national conversation, if you like.
I completely agree with you, actually. I think the one thing we also forget, I mean, I think you put your finger on it, that morality is very much a private, personal thing. We did feel that it with the cultural view in those days was that you do, there are areas you don't intrude on people's views. It's private opinion, private views, not subject to. In fact, people didn't even talk about moral or ethical issues generally. It wasn't public conversation. But also remember, morality also meant sex. In those
Yes,
days, I mean,
exactly.
it was only about sex. So if you started, got into a conversation about morality, almost certainly, if it's a trivial, relatively trivial conversation, it would end up being about sex, or avoid if it end up walking, stepping around and giggling about, or avoiding talking about sex, and assuming it was about sex. The other thing also, it would be seen as intellectually impoverished because it was seen as tied to. Low level religious discussion. It's morality is what the vicar talks about.
Yes,
He's
yes.
boring. And so the idea, I mean, we have always had a concept of the good person, but I'm not sure if the phrase being a moral person would have been a particularly positive epithet to apply to somebody in 1960.
I don't think it would have been. It
That's
would
not
have
the right
been.
word.
They were quite stuffy and they weren't liberal. They were repressed. Goody goody. It would had all those sorts of connotations. But what I want to move this on slightly and then come back finally, because we've been talking a long time now. About focus back on Jeremy, AME, and so on, but also I wanted to relate what we've just been saying to another part of your professional life, where you've had contacts. Done work with other countries, right? Especially sort of whilst and since you've been at Harvard. And I'm thinking in particular of your work in some Latin American countries, with one of our colleagues, Angela Bermudez, in Colombia, in Mexico, in Brazil, Argentina, and so on, and also latterly, a country I know reasonably well myself from having started my work there in the early 2000s, China, where of course moral education means something quite different, is complex and is ideological. And has a great deal to do with the government. Completely different from what we've just been talking about in the UK context and our historical context. So what have you learnt from your involvement with those other cultures? Some of those have been to do with citizenship, I think, and also your involvement with a lot of Chinese students, no doubt, at Harvard, and then in being associated with three or four universities in China, different ones from my own associations.
Basically, I think it's quite an interesting question because, in one sense, actually doing my first empirical study was done in Britain. Of course, the contrast was the original Kohlberg's original sample of boys in Chicago. So, to some extent, I was encountering some interesting cultural differences even there, though I didn't actually pursue it. I mean, even back in 1960, 68, the boys I was interviewing, I did only interview boys because I was doing a replication, they were already looking back, talking in terms of virtue rather than reasoning when I asked some questions about the nine moral dilemmas. But yeah, I think I got involved in. It's always quite often accidental, actually, how one ends up working in other countries. Like somebody sort of suggests you might like to do this, and you say yes, and it ends up being a 5-year or 10-year project. Yes, the first one, internationally, Angela and I didn't work in Latin America. I one of some people who Angela's associated with, we did some work, which fed into the issues around Latin America and Mexico, but that wasn't crucially what I was doing there. But my own work, I did have a very interesting doctoral student, Sally Abrahams, who was at Harvard, who was actually from Cape Town, and he was on a Kellogg Foundation scholarship, and around the end of apartheid. And he wanted to do a study on young people at the point at which apartheid ended, and they all got the vote. So he wanted to do a project in the high school in Cape Town, interviewing kids about this incredibly exciting historical moment, 1994. And he did an amazing study, and I happened to be that was when I was at Harvard doing that semester I mentioned earlier, and he'd actually come across my work in a slightly different context, and he kind of grabbed me one day and said, I didn't know him actually, and said, would I be interested in working with him? And I said yes. So his work was extremely interesting, very in depth, looking at this moment of social change when a group of young kids from the under apartheid labeling black and coloured community, coloured being of course either mixed race or designated non-white race kids in a high school in Cape Town. And that was one extremely interesting experience of cultural variation and really understanding a culture at a peak moment, an exciting moment of change. The work in China, again, it was that we mentioned my Harvard students. I had a doctoral student at Harvard from China, and she invited me to go and visit her people who she knew in Shanghai. And this eventually, I went several times to China between about 2007 onwards, and we ended up doing a project in collaboration with Biao Sang, who is a professor at East China Normal University, collecting data on high school kids in Shanghai and Nanking, again, and issues around civic awareness, shading into moral. I mean, the boundaries are very, very fuzzy. And of course, as you say, Chinese kids, a lot of their ethical concerns are very much within the civic domain. Partly, it's partly historical, of course. I mean, China is beginning to realize and acknowledge the fact that post-Maoist communism is very close to Confucianism in many ways, and particularly the fundamental ethical moral qualities that are valued in a society which is a communally oriented society like China.
Well, in some
Very.
ways, that's it's in some ways the what I take from that and Neo-Confucianism is that actually that's much more fundamental to Chinese society and its inherent value system
Yeah, it is
than
absolutely.
anything imposed by by a government, according, the ideology, if you like, because of course there is one in Confucianism, is basically stronger in the social sphere, and the importance of the family comes directly from that.
Well, basically, I think I think that basically, I mean, Mao's original formulation of his theory was based on Lenin, and so there's that element of Marxist-Leninist ideology involved. But actually, he was actually building on that and building on the Confucian roots, particularly the extreme importance of being a social being, being part of a community. And the obligations that one has to the community are straightforward Confucian, and they translate very nicely into a society which is a communalistic as well as communistic society. And so I think the links between Confucianism and whatever it was, I wouldn't even call it Maoism now, it's a different philosophy slightly. But I don't think you can say put it into the government is not imposing something on top of people that it is not completely, as you say, inherently part of their perspectives. Which is why I think, in some ways, it's a loose parallel, trying to impose Kantian deontological, essentially German philosophy, on a virtue-based Aristotelian culture like Britain was not going to go down very well. I think if you think it like that, and if we had tried to create a moral education program based primarily on Aristotelian virtues back in the day, we might have been more successful in getting a public image of ourselves. I don't know. It's a hypothetical question to discuss in 2,000 words. But I mean, in some ways, I felt that I always felt, always when I was not recently, but I felt I was sounding a bit like an Americanized version of a Germanic Kantian deontologist, rather than something that fitted in with my neighborhood ethics in Britain. So other countries I've worked in, well, those are the ones I've collected data in, actually.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting experience to really get under the skin as much as one can in an empirical study of another culture. And I feel with China, I am absolutely not an expert on China, but I have a sense of sort of tendrils of awareness of the cultural difference between America and us and China, from the work I've done with a wonderful team of people in China. And it's insightful. I mean, one of the big insights for me has been the realization that whatever culture you're in, as a scholar and academic, you're in that culture. And you are going to think in that culture, and you can't get out of that culture. The benefit of changing cultures is you become aware of it. And if you change culture at the age of seven, it helps. But basically, if you have always been in your own culture, and you've never had the opportunity to realize that you're in this bubble, you're not going to be able to see the world in any other way than the one you've grown up with, because it's fish and sea, you know. The fish doesn't know it's in water.
I think that's a very important point you make. And you and I have both been privileged to be able to make those leaps from time to time in our work, right? And our real engagement with other people through the work that you've done that we briefly sort of touched upon today, and in different cultures. And you've said in your writing you thought it was very important to be open-minded. Well, of course, that's one of the things by, the popular phrase "travel broadens the mind," right? Well, it's not going to broaden the mind unless your mind is open to it. And we've also been lucky to have our minds opened for us slightly by our professional colleagues and students whom we've been in contact, who have enabled us, especially when we don't speak their language, to have some insights into their minds and their cultures.
Absolutely, yes.
We couldn't have done it without them,
Yes,
in many cases. So we need to recognize that and how little we do know about cross cultures and that work. Whilst also, both of us, I think we've been quite proactive in that and wanting to support people through writing papers for the journal, you with students and so on, so forth with all of that. If I can just bring it back to so we can finish, Helen, that when I wrote to you and you said you sent me your lengthy and distinctive CV, and you've had a number of awards and recognitions, and you've been tremendously active, not only in what most people would have considered a full-time career, and you've had your own family life. But you've also been a key person in many, excuse me, professional organizations. We can't go into them all here. But I was a bit surprised when you didn't really rate, or you didn't seem to recall, shall I put it perhaps more politely that way, your connection with moral education in through the Journal of Moral Education, because you were the one of the longest serving people on the editorial board. For example, you joined in 1990 and you finished in 2021. That's 30 years. You during that time were always a, excuse me, assiduous reviewer of papers. You wrote several papers yourself, which were published in JME. We've only talked about the early ones, but recently, deconstructing the elephant and the flag in the lavatory. What a title is that, right? And I invited you to write a paper for my swan song, the special issue of the journal in 2011, personal, political, and professional, or whatever it was, some combination of the three Ps. And you wrote about discovering commitment and dialogue in culture, which I think, in a way, sums up what we've been talking about today, right? And you were committed as a trustee of the journal for 16 years, from 1997 to 2013, and indeed you were chair of the Journal of Moral Education Trust from 2007 to 2013. Now, that's just a brief illustration of your service commitment, Helen, and that's only one organisation. And I have a list here of it must be a dozen or more than a dozen other organisations that you've had roles in and have had recognition from. So, you've been a person of huge energy, not just passion, right? But it's been energy. And I know because of my involvement with the JME all that time, and sometimes with you, when you were chairing the trust, and I was the editor, we had a different relationship then. I know how committed you were to all of it. You don't just go in for the broad brush. You really get down to the detail, and you like revising rules, for example, and all that kind of thing, as well as thinking, as you demonstrated in this conversation, much more widely. You didn't have to do all that, is what I want to say. So that again, I think, was part of another outlet of your private passions in a way.
Well, thank you for that. I hadn't really thought of it in quite those terms, but I suppose yes, the journal has been very important to me. I was very I feel very warm towards the journal. I feel part of the journal. I mean, I think it's part of my life and I'm part of it. And I feel maybe that's why I don't say a lot about it, because it was almost sort of, it was just there all the time and I was there involved with it and the people with it. And it's like family, really. I think in that sense, and it's always been very supportive. I mean, not just it, but I mean, the community around it's always been very supportive to the things I cared about. And I think, yes, it was. I mean, that certainly was an important part of, important strand of my life, an important area of my life. And I remember when I organized the AME conference in 2016 in Harvard, and that was again an extremely interesting experience of bringing together so many different strands of my life, my world, my thinking, and the people who I cared about. That was a very nice experience. Extremely exhausting, but a very nice experience. Yes, I think it has been an important part of my life and a very valuable part, and some wonderful people, really
Yes, you
fantastic
hosted a
people.
wonderful conference there in Harvard. It was very extremely well attended and well organized. It was well appreciated. And I think it's fortunate that AME was able to recognize you. And you were awarded the Kuhmerker Award in our joint conference and with APNME, JME, AME, APNME in Nanjing in 2011. And I was the one who got to present it to you, Helen, because I was involved in the
Thank
award committee at the time. And you and I have since been involved together in the award committee.
you.
That's another connection. Another point I want to make about AME is you did what I considered was a splendid lecture, Kohlberg Memorial Lecture in Barcelona at the AME conference in 2018, when you were brave enough to say, are we asking the right questions? Right. Now, I think that sums it up really. You've always been quite provocative. You haven't been afraid to ask the questions and to plug away at them, and with degree of enthusiasm, open-mindedness. You've been willing to listen to other people whilst having your own perspective, as we all should have. Now, this is a long history of work, Helen. You're still working, dare I say it, into your 80s. And can I ask you, finally, was it all hard work or was there some fun?
Oh, good heavens. Well, it was loads of fun, and it was hard work, but it was stimulating. I mean, some of it was inevitably there are bits of one's life and one's work which are a little bit more mundane, should we say, but mostly I've been pretty lucky. I could actually choose a lot of the time. I was lucky, actually. You mentioned earlier on that I was in a department in Bath which allowed me to do what I wanted to do, and that's true. And I was very lucky that a lot of people at that stage of their career, someone leans on them and they're not free. So I have been lucky to be able to make my own choices, and I've also been lucky that those choices were, on the whole, good choices. In the sense of producing really interesting outcomes and working with wonderful people, almost all of whom I've remained in close contact with all my life. It's been a pretty exciting time in many ways. Thank you for those kind things you said about me. I very much appreciate them.
Well, I've always felt we've had, as I said earlier, we've had a relationship over a long period of time that sort of dipped in and out, and we've had different roles and responsibilities with respect to each other and also alongside one another. Which is not always the case with people's, and I think I hope I'm right in saying our relationship has always been both respectful and warm,
Oh, extremely. I mean,
and that I have valued that, and I think you've understood where I've come from sometimes. So, you know, that's just one of your many relationships with people across the field that you've been such a key contributor to, Helen. And I just wanted to acknowledge that. And your real, all your efforts and the friendship and mentorship you've given many people over the years, and your efforts to push the field that we've been talking about forward and always into new directions and courses, and the fact that you've had a very broad overview of it and moved on in different directions. You know, that's really more than anybody could expect. So I hope you feel valued, Helen, and recognised, because that too is very important.
well, Monica, that is so kind, and indeed, I very much value my friendship with you. As you say, it's 50 years pretty much, and it's been very valuable to me. As has the relationships you mentioned with other people. And yes, Jamie has been an important, and that world more broadly has been an important part. And I valued it, and I felt valued by it. So, I've been very fortunate to have the opportunities to be part of that, and I've been very fortunate to have the kind of support from the people in it and that kind of world. So thank you again. Thank you
Yes.
again for
And thank
everything.
you, Helen, for this lovely conversation today. I really appreciate your time and thoughtfulness.
Thank you.